Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
Well, I could tell you a little bit about the regulation of aggression. One of the things I studied, especially when I was in Montreal, was the development of antisocial behavior in children and in adolescence. And antisocial children, so they tend to be aggressive. Antisocial children tend to turn into antisocial. There's conduct disorder, technically speaking. Conduct disordered children tend to turn into conduct disordered adolescents, and then they tend to turn into antisocial and criminal adults. And so I can tell you a little bit about how that progresses, I think, because it's quite interesting. And it isn't what people generally think. So the first thing is, if you want to be criminal, the best way to do it is to be really low in agreeableness and really low in conscientiousness. Because low in agreeableness means things are for me and not for you. And you're not going to get me to do a damn thing that I don't want to do. And I'll stand my ground. And low in conscientiousness means you can do all the work and I'll sit back and take the benefits. And so if you have someone who's really disagreeable and really unconscientious, you have someone who's starting to border on psychopath. And if you add high intelligence and high emotional stability to that, then you have someone who won't work but will reap the benefits, who doesn't give a damn about you, who's assertive as hell and who's smart. And a person like that's also going to be charismatic, because extroverted, disagreeable people are kind of narcissistic, but they'll put themselves forward strongly. And if they don't show any signs of fear, that also indicates that they're confident. And it's easy for people to confuse that with competence. And that's how psychopaths get away with what they're doing, although they have to move from person to person because their reputation will track them. So anyways, back to the development of aggression in children, the development of criminality in adults. Here's how it seems to work, at least in part. It's more complicated than this, but I'll put in some of the sociological elements as well. So if you take children and you group them together in age, in groups defined by age, so let's say you have 32-year-olds, 33-year-olds, 34-year-olds, all the way up to 18, and then you watch them interact and you code their behavior for kicking, biting, fighting, and property theft, then what you'll find is that the 2-year-olds are by far the most aggressive of the lot. So that's pretty interesting, you know, because you think, well, children are naturally peaceful, and if they're aggressive, it's because they learn it. It's like, no, that's true for a small minority of children. But there's a substantial number of children who are aggressive at 2 by nature. Most of them are male. Now, that doesn't mean most children are like that, because they're not. Even if you look at 2-year-olds who are the most aggressive human beings, most 2-year-olds aren't aggressive, but some of them are, and most of those are male. Okay, so then let's say you identify this cohort of aggressive 2-year-olds and you track them across time, track them for the next 2 to 4 years, track them until they're 4 years old. What you find is the vast majority of the hyper-aggressive male 2-year-olds get socialized perfectly well. So by the time they're 4, they're temperamentally probably still more aggressive, but they've become civilized little monsters so other people can tolerate them. And that means that they've had parents or peers or educational experiences that enabled them to learn how to interact productively with other kids and to bring their aggressive nature under control. Some of that seems to be mediated by the opportunity to engage in rough and tumble play. And that's one of the things that we know that helps socialize rats, for example. It's vital to them, but it also seems to really be good for socializing young kids. And rough and tumble play, which is something that adult males particularly like to do with young kids, by the way, not before 9 months, because they're just too little, but once they become ambulatory and, you know, kind of puppy-like, so that they're a little bit more robust, then you can play a lot with them, and you can play with them right at the edge of danger too, which kids absolutely, they absolutely go nuts for that. They love that. So when I had little kids, I made this kind of wrestling ring out of these two couches that we had that would hook together. And I'd bring them on there and, you know, toss them up in the air and catch them, you know, 8, 10 feet. No. A foot in the air and catch them. And they'd go like this, and then, you know, I'd catch them and they'd laugh and I'd throw them up and they're all freaked out and then they'd laugh. And, you know, so they're learning trust with that in an embodied way. And they're also learning, and this is from stretching them out and wrestling them and twisting them around and letting them pull on your hair and hit you and all of those things. They learn deep in their bones exactly what can hurt them and what doesn't. And you want to kind of push them to the edge, you know, so that they can tell the difference between what hurts and what's still within the realm of the game. And you do the same thing when they're wrestling with you. So they learn not to, you know, awkwardly stick their thumb in your eye or do things that are actually painful, like grab your lip and pull it. You know, it's like, no, you let go of my lip, you know. And so that seems to help regulate the aggressive impulses and help the child find a more appropriate embodiment. You could think that what you're doing in some sense when you're rough and tumble playing with kids is teaching them how to dance, because that is what you're doing. You know, you're making them comfortable in their bodies, in all of its extension, and building in that kind of body fluency that you see in people who are well situated inside themselves. And so that's something to really think about, you know, and it's appalling. We know that the ability to engage in rough and tumble play among rats inhibits aggression, impulsive aggression among rats. We also know that if you deprive rats of the opportunity to engage in rough and tumble play, they show prefrontal cortical developmental deficits and manifest behaviors that are akin to attention deficit disorder, which you can then treat with Ritalin. And so one of the things that's happening with boys, because they're way more dosed with attention deficit disorder medication than girls, is that their natural proclivity to engage in robust and troublesome active play isn't appropriate for a school environment where you're just supposed to sit down and shut up. And so the kids get hyperactive. And instead of letting them out to run around until they fall over half exhausted, which is exactly what you should do, you know, you medicate them so that their exploratory systems, which are the activity of which is facilitated by the dopaminergic agonist, that's the ADHD medication, suppresses the play function. It's absolutely appalling. There's no excuse for it. You know, but it's a good indictment of the education system, because why in the world would you take six-year-old kids and get them to sit without moving for 5 hours? Unless you want them to grow up fat and stupid, why in the world would you train them to do that? Well, it's easier. That's one thing. You know, and when they're sitting there, there's nothing disruptive about the rough and tumble play, and that can be quite, you know, play can be quite disruptive. So anyways, most of these kids are reasonably well socialized by the time they're the age of 4. Using one mechanism or another. They learn how to regulate their aggression, and they learn how to engage in fictional play structures with other kids. They learn how to cooperate and compete. And the advantage to having a well-socialized, disagreeable person is that they really don't let much get in their way. So if you can get a kid who's disagreeable socialized, that person can be quite the creature, you know, because they're very forward-moving in their nature and very difficult to stop. But if you don't get them successfully domesticated, tamed, roughly speaking, by the time they're 4, their peers reject them. And that's a big problem, because your job as a parent is to make your child socially desirable by the age of 4. Like, you want to burn that into your brain, because people don't know that. That's your job. And here's why. It's easy if you think about it carefully. So you imagine You've got a 3-year-old child, so sort of halfway through that initial period of socialization, and you take that child out in public. Okay, what do you want for the child? Who cares about you? What do you want for the child? You want the child to be able to interact with other children and adults so that the children are welcoming and smile and want to play with him or her, and so the adults are happy to see the child and treat him or her properly. And if your child's a horrible little monster because you're afraid of disciplining them or you don't know how to do that properly, then what they're going to do is they're going to experience nothing but rejection from other children and false smiles from other parents and adults. And that's so then you're throwing the child out there into a world where every single face that they see is either hostile or lying. And that's not something that's going to be particularly conducive to the mental health or the well-being of your child. If your child can learn a couple simple rules of behavior, like don't interrupt adults when they're talking too much and pay attention and try not to hit the other kids over the head with the truck any more than is absolutely necessary, then and share and play properly, then when they meet other kids, the kids are going to try out a few little play routines on them, and that's going to go well, and then they're going to go off and socialize each other for the rest of their lives. Because that's what happens, is that from 4 years old onwards, the primary socialization with children takes place among other children. And so if the kids don't get in on that early, they don't move into that developmental spiral upwards, and they're left behind. When men go bad, they often go bad by being antisocial and tyrannical. So, you know, where there's way more antisocial men than there are antisocial women, which is why there's 20 times as many men in jail as there are women. You know, so each gender, let's say each sex, has its own characteristic pathologies. And there are some antisocial women, you know, and there are some high neuroticism guys or some guys who are really agreeable as well. So, but they're rarer. You might say, well, if you're only going to interact with someone once, you might as well just take advantage of them and run off. That's what a psychopath does, by the way. And there is room in the environmental niche for psychopaths, but they have to keep moving around, because otherwise people figure out who they are. So they just move around, and they can take advantage of one person, you know, maybe 5 times or 10 times or something, and then the reputation spreads and they got to get the hell out of there. But so it's not a good long-term strategy. If you're preyed upon by a psychopath, which you will be to some degree at some point in your life, the psychopath, who will be narcissistic, will presume that you're stupid and that you deserve to be taken advantage of because you're naive and stupid. So it's actually a good thing that he's doing it. And his proof for, and I'm saying he because there are more male psychopaths, the proof that you're stupid, naive, is that he can take advantage of you. And so, like, if you were wiser, you'd be, you know, you'd know his tricks, and then it wouldn't be morally necessary for him to show you just exactly who knows what about what. And so the psychopath will use his ability to fool you as proof of his own grandiose omnipotence, omniscience, and narcissism. And the problem with that is that you can be fooled by a psychopath, and virtually anybody can. So that Robert Hare, for example, who studied psychopaths for a long time and interviewed a lot of them, like hundreds of them, and videotaped many of the interviews, he said when he was talking to the psychopath, he always believed what they were saying. And then he'd watch the video afterwards and see where the conversation went off the rails. But, you know, the proclivity to be polite in a conversation is very strong. And if you're polite, you don't object to the way that the person unfolds their strategy, you know. And psychopaths are pretty good at figuring out how to manipulate, obviously, how to manipulate people. And the probability that you will be immune to that is extraordinarily low. Go watch Paul Bernardo being interviewed by policemen on YouTube. That's enlightening, man. Paul Bernardo, he's like the CEO of a meeting in that video, you know. He gives the cops hell, he gives the lawyers hell, he protests his innocence. He basically tells them that they're rude and untrustworthy because they don't trust him because he did a few little things 17 years ago. But he basically goes, well, you know, that's a long time ago. It's like, we're past that, aren't we? I mean, I'm having a discussion with you. I'm trying to help you solve some crimes, which, by the way, I committed, but we won't bring that up. You know, and you're accusing me of being a liar. Like, you're not playing fair. What's up with you? And then when they answer, he looks at his fingernails, which is like, that's a lovely little manipulative thing, because it basically means whatever happens to be under my fingernail at the moment is much higher priority than listening to your foolish story. And you watch, you'll see people do that to you. And then you get a little insight into what they're up to. He's very good at that. And so, or he looks outside, or he just looks at his hands, or he looks out the window, immediately dismissive in his nonverbal behavior. It's brilliant. The courts were forced to release that, by the way. But look it up, Paul Bernardo on YouTube. Wow, it's just mind-boggling. He's so good at what he does. And he's good-looking, and he's charismatic, and, you know, he can really pull it off. And you can't tell what's happening with the cops and the lawyers, whether they're just letting him play his routine to get some information from him, or whether he's actually setting them back on his heels. And I suspect it's a bit of both. But it's a masterful performance. If you didn't know who he was, and you were watching it without the audio, you'd think he's the CEO of some company giving his employees hell for not being up to scratch. That's all his body language, his eye contact, everything just speaks that. It's amazing. So anyways, you got these two-bit hoods here who think they're really something. They also think they're tough and dangerous, and they're not. They're just, you know, cowardly and corner dwellers, and they confuse their unwillingness to abide by reasonable rules as indication of their heroic courage, which is something else that low-rent hoods like to do, you know. And it's partly because lots of people who just...
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance in the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown in the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offering, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM. Make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-ALL for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back in unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Attend to the law. Do that because they're cowardly, which is a Nietzschean observation. Are you good or are you just afraid? Well, let's start with afraid first before we proceed to good. And that the reason that you follow the rules is because you're afraid of getting caught. Yeah, well, you know those kids who, often university kids, who are in like a hockey riot and they end up breaking windows and stealing things and, you know, they get nailed for it and afterwards they're really blown away by their own behavior. It's like, well, they're in that camp. It's like they think they're good people, but they're not. They're just never anywhere where you could be bad. And as soon as you put them somewhere where they could be bad, it's like out it comes, just like that. And that's really worth thinking about, because most of you, many of you, but not all of you, I suspect, have never really been somewhere that you could be really bad and get away with it. And so you might think, well, you wouldn't do it, but people do it. And if you give in to that temptation, which you often will, then it wins, and because it wins, it gets a little dopamine kick and it grows stronger. Anything you let win, the internal argument, grows. And anything you let be defeated shrinks, because it's punished. It doesn't get to have its way. So that's another thing really to remember. Don't practice what you do not want to become. And because they're neurological circuits. You build those things in there, man. They're not going anywhere. You can build another little machine to inhibit them. That's the best you can do. Once they're in there, you can't get them out. So, and then the ones you build to inhibit can be taken out by stress, and the old habits will come back up. So you got to be careful what you say and what you do, because you build yourself that way. Something's behind the scenes pulling the strings. And everybody always wonders what that is, right? What's actually going on? What's actually going on with Trump? Who's actually in control? Is it Putin? I mean, that's the fantasies of the left. It's Putin. It's like, well, the question always is, what's going on behind the scene, right? And the question is, that's the case certainly on the political landscape, business landscape, interpersonal relationship. What are you really up to? Everyone's always wondering that, right? That's why they're watching your eyes. Because your eyes point at things, and they can infer what you're interested in and what you're up to by looking at what you look at. And that's why your eyes have whites, is so that we can see where you're pointing them. because gorillas don't. And so what that means, roughly speaking, is that all of your ancestors whose eyes couldn't be reliably tracked were either killed or didn't mate. It's a big deal for us to see where people's eyes are pointed. And so we're always watching each other's eyes constantly. What are you up to? What are you up to? What are you looking at? What do you want? And I want to know, because if I know what you want, I can predict how you're going to behave. And that also means I can cooperate with you, or I can compete with you, or I can lie to you. But all the information is in the eyes, surrounded by the facial display, right? Because that's also an indication of motivation and emotion. And so we're our eyes are so good at that, that for you guys sitting there in the back, I can tell if you're looking at my eyes or at my chin. And the deviation in your eyes is so tiny that it's a kind of miracle that we're capable of making that perceptual observation. It's really important to us. One of the things that was really big, and it's probably even worse now, when I was a parent of young children, was to teach your kids how to be afraid of strangers. It's like, no, wrong. That is not what you teach them. Because all you do is teach them then to be timid and fearful, and the real predatory types, they're pretty much thrilled about that. Because you'll also make them sheltered and naive. You know, so that isn't, you make your kids courageous and you get their damn eyes open, and that's the best thing you can do to protect them against people who are truly dangerous. So none of that terrifying them. And then with regards to your partner, here's something to think about with regards to roles. So my wife and I have had this discussion many times, and one of the discussions is, well, how are we to treat each other in public? And it isn't, her name is Tammy, the discussion isn't how should Jordan treat Tammy in public, or how should Tammy treat Jordan? That's not the discussion. This isn't personal. It's how should a wife treat her husband, and how should a husband treat his wife? It's impersonal. And it's partly, you don't put your partner down in public. Why? Well, it's not because you're hurting that person's feelings. That's not why. It's that you're denigrating the relationship that you are in voluntarily. You know, and I've some of the most painful days I've ever spent, one in particular I spent with a group of men who had been in therapy for their marriage and who bloody well needed it, I can tell you that. And they spent their whole day complaining about their wives. Like, it just made me sweat the whole day. I thought, I can't believe I'm here with you guys. I can't tell you why I was. It's just, you know, it was just happenstance more than anything. And I thought, how can you be so damn dumb? It's like, it's certainly possible that you married barbarian witches. Fine. But you don't have, you're so lacking in sense that you would discuss that in public, not noticing that you picked them. So basically all you're doing is holding up a sign and waving it constantly that says, I'm an idiot, right? And so, well, back to responsibility. You have a responsibility to those whom you love and are obligated to ensure that they manifest themselves in a manner that's most beneficial to them over the long run. Now, you have the same responsibility, I would say, to yourself, but you'll have blind spots. Other people have to help you with that. But so the rule is, you know, you help your wife figure out how not to make a fool of herself in public. And she extends to you the same courtesy. And it's partly maintenance of the sacred nature of the relationship. It has nothing to do with you or her, precisely. It's broader and wider than that. Okay, so then that's two levels of responsibility. Child, partner, next level of responsibility. You're asked at your workplace to undergo unconscious bias retraining. And you say yes. It's like, okay, you've just admitted that you're a bigot. Right? Because you're acting it out. It's like, I'm a racist bigot, obviously I need to be retrained. And so you might say, well, I'm not going to make a fuss about it, right? Or I've been told to do it. Or maybe you agree with it, fine. And if you agree with it, no problem. You can make a case for it. I think it's a weak and appalling case, personally. But you can make a case for it. You could say, well, you know, I am interested in my biases and how to rectify them. And, like, fair enough, you know, people are biased. But if you object to it, and you don't say anything, then you're complicit. And then it's on you. And you know, like, A causes B and C, and B causes C and D, and so forth. The thing doesn't always, but it has this tendency to expand. And you'll come home angry, and upset, and you'll go to the training program and you'll think this is ridiculous, because that is what you'll think in all likelihood, and you won't say anything. But it eats at you. Well, you've abrogated your responsibility. And so, and then you might say, well, so then that's how the community becomes corrupt. That's how the community starts to be corrupt, is that people turn a blind eye to emergent pathology when they know it's pathological. That's exactly what the Egyptian story says. Osiris is overcome by Seth because he's willfully blind. Willfully blind, which means he knows, but refuses to, he knows, quote, his predator detection systems have gone off. Monster. Well, then you're supposed to look, okay, exactly what sort of monster is this? Well, it doesn't have wings, it doesn't have a tail, you know. You cut it down into the, you cut it from the monster that it could be into the monster that it is. That's the first step. And then you take the appropriate steps. And then you also notice the other monsters, because here's something to think about. You're going to pay a price for speaking up. But you're going to pay a price for not speaking up. So it's like monsters on the right, monsters on the left. Pick the ones you want to battle with. If you decide not to make your stand, you weaken yourself. If you do it 100 times, then even if the monster was only this big, now you're this big. It's going to eat you. You know, when it was this big, you probably could have kicked it across the room. It's too late for that. You've capitulated and capitulated. You know, and so what you've done, and this is a way to think about it from a Jungian perspective, this is what Jung was trying to get at when he was talking about alchemy. It's like the thing that pops up to object to you is this incredibly complex entity. It's the entire world encapsulated in the event. If you interact with it, you unpack it. You differentiate your sense of the world, and you gather new skills. Let's say we're having a conversation, and it's flowing melodically, and all of a sudden I say something, and there's a disjunction, right? You're offended by it. There's some negative emotion that comes up, or you know, maybe I've said something to impress you or to be arrogant, and you respond badly. It's like we've got this melodic thing going on. It's a consensual frame, and something pokes itself up to put a disjunction in the conversation. It's like, well, that's where the information is. It's like something went wrong. Something didn't work out. I'm not looking at the world properly, or I don't know you well enough, or as well as I thought. There's something there, and if I have any sense, I'm going to focus my attention on that. Like, not obsessively or anything like that, but that's where all the information is. Because as long as what we're doing is working, then we both know enough already. As soon as what we're doing together isn't working, then that's instant evidence that there's something about us that needs to be updated. And you might think, well, that's a terrible thing. And the answer is yes, of course it is. It's a terrible thing. But it's also the thing, and this is the next stage of the development of this, let's call it universal morality. It's like the universal morality might be found in the answer to the question, what should you do when you make a mistake? Now, one answer is catastrophic dissolution. That's a collapse into chaos. Well, that's, no one is going to pick that voluntarily. Let's put it that way. It's unbelievably unpleasant, terribly anxiety-provoking, shameful, and painful all at the same time. Worse, it can mean the absence of positive emotion, because if you really collapse into chaos, not only are you overwhelmed by negative emotion, but the positive emotion system shut off, and that's what happens to someone who's extraordinarily depressed and also hyper-anxious at the same time. Not only are they suffering from an excess of negative emotion, but they've got no incentive movement forward whatsoever. Okay, so that's not an optimal solution because it takes you out. The other possible, and so I would call that a nihilistic solution or a chaotic solution. It's not a solution, it's a dissolution. And you could think about it as a precursor to a potential solution, but it's very easy to get stuck there. And that's why Jonah could have stayed in the belly of the whale along with all the other people that were eaten by the whale and never got back out. And you see people like that all the time. Their error has come along, blown out their frames of reference, they've collapsed into the underworld, into the chaotic underworld, and they don't know how to get out. They have post-traumatic stress disorder, or they're depressed, or they're hyper-anxious, or they're resentful and aggressive and destructive. Like, there's any number of states of being that can overwhelm you, when the bottom has fallen out of your life. So it isn't something that people are going to... It's not an optimal solution, let's put it that way. Well, the other... That's a nihilistic solution, a collapse. The other solution is, we're talking, and I don't get what I want from you, and so I say, you better not do that again. I don't want to see that from you again. And so that's a tyrannical attitude, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to take my universe of order and its predictions, and I'm going to say, you go along with this, or I'm going to punish you. And that's a... Now, there is an element in society, like society is made up of threats like that to some degree. It's an ineradicable part of society. That would be the tyrannical aspect of the great king, let's say. You know, we've organized a set of punishments and threats that keep each of us in alignment. However, generally speaking, in a society that's functional, we've decided to adopt agreement with that set of principles more or less voluntarily. And we say, well, you have rights and responsibilities, and I have rights and responsibilities, and I'm willing to pay a price for yours, including the acceptance of punishment if I transgress, but you're going to do the same for me. So there are intelligent ways that punishment and threat can be used and bounded. So, but that can easily degenerate into tyranny. And one of the methods that I can choose to use, if I don't want to encounter error, is just to enforce my will on everyone else. And I think when that happens personally and in the family and in the community and in the state all at the same time, then you get the emergence of a tyranny.
Hey, football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown in the game, but his teammate scores instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you a second chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. With BetMGM's second chance offer, you have a chance to keep the fun going after the first player crosses the goal line. Try a first TD score wager with confidence today. BetMGM, make it legendary. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This specific promotional offer is not available in Mississippi, Pennsylvania, Puerto Rico, or Ontario. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 for New York. 1-800-NEXT-STEP for Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 for Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF for Iowa. 1-800-981-0023 for Puerto Rico. Existing customer offer. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards paid back and unrestricted withdrawable funds. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.